Like Virgil, I'd like to extend my appreciation for everyone being with us this morning. Yesterday, Cheryl asked me what I was going to be preaching on, and I said, silence. Now, you could take that in a couple of different ways, perhaps related to the silence of the scriptures and how we should respond to that. You could perhaps take it in terms of times we need to keep our mouths shut. Neither one of those are the topics we're going to be talking about today. What we are going to be talking about is sometimes called the silent years. So if you were reading the Bible in a chronological manner, in terms of when different events occurred, or when different passages were written, you could read something like this. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Now, if you notice, I put in what's sometimes called an ellipsis, little three dots there. There's a break, if you will, between, you know, the period there, talking about striking the earth, and in the days of Herod. If you do a little bit of digging, you'll recognize that this passage here comes from Malachi chapter 4, which happens to be the end of the Old Testament, written somewhere around 435 B.C. This passage here comes from the Gospel of Luke, first chapter, describing events that occurred 8 B.C. to 4 B.C., somewhere in there. And if you do the quick math, basically those three dots represent over 400 years. What happened between the two? So we have, if you will, a biblical narrative that's, you know, making certain demands, if you will, upon the Jewish readers. There's prophecy, and then in the next virtual sentence, if you will, we're talking about Zacharias, who is a certain priest. And of course, if you're familiar with the narrative, you know that basically is describing the origin of John the Baptist or John the Immerser. Big gap between the two. Not covered by the Bible. Hence the silence of the scriptures. Or at least in this case, the silent years. Now, you might ask yourself, well, okay, since it's not in the Bible, must not have been important. Why bother? Why care? Well, one reason is, in those little three little dots, there's a lot going on that shape, if you will, the context of the New Testament. Various regional events, various people, various customs, various languages, various concepts, etc., that occur between the end of Malachi and Luke chapter 1 that sort of set the stage that if you don't know, you're just going to drop right into the New Testament and get hit with all kinds of things, including terms that are brand new, that you don't find in the Old Testament. Just, boop. All of a sudden, all different kinds of concepts, behaviors, customs, units of money, religious groups, that just sort of pop on the scene. You go, where did all these come from? Right? But if you kind of know what happened in the three dots, or in the silent years, you'll go, oh, okay, yeah, I can see how that fits in, etc. Almost like to set the stage. So one of the legitimate questions that we would need to ask ourselves is, okay, so if we want to understand history in that 430, 450 year time period, where do we go? not in the Bible. Well, you would go to everywhere else you go to understand history. You know, secular historians, contemporaries of the time, to include, you know, Greek historians, Roman historians, even Josephus, who lived in the first century. You know, he wrote about this period of time in Jewish history, for instance. There is another source, which I hesitate a little bit, but it is something that we should at least mention, and that's called the Apocrypha. That particular term typically is used within, I'll say, Protestant circles. If you're, there's an equivalent over within Catholicism called books that are deuterocanonical. Same term, same books, just different terms. Basically means hidden or of doubtful origin. Now, these books were written starting off roughly around 200 BC, stretching all the way past, you know, New Testament times by another, you know, 400 years, large span of time. But some do cover the period of time we're looking at, and even at least two of them, which you may or may not have heard of, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you know, does purport to be a history of Jewish events, you know, during that period of time. You know, not inspired, best we can tell. But then again, secular historians aren't either. And so going to, you know, history of any nature, you kind of have to rely on, you know, the best sources that were available. And you kind of have to take it with, you know, a grain of salt, so to speak. But at least it gives you some sense of what likely occurred. So in terms of where we're starting, let me kind of give a little bit of context. So we have, of course, King Saul, King David, King Solomon, back here roughly around 950, 1000 BC. You know, the dominant superpower, if you will, in the area was Egypt. Of course, after Solomon dies, the kingdom divides up. The Assyrians rise into power. Eventually, the northern kingdom of Israel falls to them. The Assyrians eventually, as a kind of a dominant power, are replaced by the Babylonians. And of course, Judah falls to them. Some 70-some odd years in initial captivity. And then another, you know, dominant power, and of course, you'll see this kind of pattern repeated over and over again, comes into power, if you will. Medes and the Persians, Medo-Persian Empire, if you will. Somewhere roughly in that period of time, you've got the Book of Esther, now down in the 400s, if you will. You've got the second and third return of Jews to the Promised Land, the land of Canaan. And you've got the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And then finally, again, roughly around 435, you've got Malachi being written, best we can tell. Now, one of the things I'll mention is you may notice this particular progression of, you know, regional superpowers. Not too surprising if you understand and pause for a moment and think about the geography of the Promised Land, the land of Canaan, the land of Judea, whatever. Being, if you will, situated right in between, you know, the continent of Africa and Europe and Asia. And of course, if any superpower is going to be, you know, taking on Egypt, or Egypt's going to expand, whatever, you're constrained right in that area, land of Palestine, between the Mediterranean Sea and basically wilderness. And so any sort of conquering armies, they're going to come through there. And they did, time after time after time after time, as you can kind of see through the top part of the chart. The next kind of chart basically says, okay, so we're starting off with the Book of Malachi, last book in physical order, last book in terms of when written, in terms of the Old Testament. Some themes that are very common, very similar to throughout the Minor Prophets, you know, reinforcement of God's love for Israel, pointing out that even though they had been in Babylonian captivity and allowed to return back to the land of Canaan, that they were once again becoming unfaithful, both priests and the people. A call for repentance and a promise that Elijah would return. And the day of the Lord was going to be coming. So that's where we're kind of starting. And this reference to Elijah, very curious, makes me wonder what they thought of when they read that. That Elijah was going to come and, quote unquote, prepare the way for the Lord, looking forward. It's the last prophecy, if you will, pointing forward from the Old Testament out into something in the future. So another way of kind of viewing this, if you will, again, Malachi, rough around 435, you've got the promised coming of Elijah and with other prophets as well, wrapped up with the coming Messiah, the anointed one. There are certain prophecies about the Messiah being suffering, a lot of prophecies about his kingdom, a lot of prophecies about the day of the Lord. So on this side of the gap, if you will, you've got these sorts of anticipated events. Looking out briefly, this is like a real quick survey or summary, and then we'll kind of get into the details. So you have the rise of the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great. We'll talk about that a little bit. We have, during that period of time, the writing of the Septuagint, which we'll talk about in a few moments. We have the division of his empire into technically four main areas, geographic areas, two of which are of interest to us, under the Ptolemies and under the Seleucids, basically given to two of his generals, the area of his kingdom given to two generals. We'll see the Maccabean revolt during this time against Greece and the Seleucids. We'll also see the rise of Rome, as well as the capture of Jerusalem eventually by the Romans. We'll see the rise of a series of governors and local kings to include Herod the Great. And on the far end of the gap, if you will, we'll see the birth of John the Baptist along with Jesus of Nazareth, roughly around 8 to 4 BC. Both of them starting their respective ministries, roughly, rough dates. Crucifixion of Jesus, resurrection, start of the church around 30 AD, 30 or 33, depending. His spiritual kingdom, and eventually around 7 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Romans. So what you have then at that point is closure of the gap, if I could use those terms, with Elijah having come, not literally reincarnated, not resurrected, but in the form of or the spirit of John the Baptist, John the Immerser, along with the Messiah, Jesus, suffering, setting up his kingdom, and at least in a sense, the day of the Lord, visitation of God's wrath on the Jews by means of the Romans. So that's sort of like the overview. So now we're going to slow down, walk our way through, talk about the rise of Greece. So roughly about 100 years after Malachi, the Medo-Persian Empire, which we mentioned before, which includes the land of Canaan, eventually falls to the great general, Alexander, roughly around 330. And with that, you have now the introduction into the promised land, into the land of Canaan, Greek language, Greek culture, Greek religion, which we will see becomes very influential in the New Testament narrative. We also see that not long after, or at his death, I should say, again, roughly around low 300s, that empire, which spanned all the way from Greece down to southern portion of Egypt, let's say, Asia Minor, all the way to India, massive empire for the time. When Alexander died, that empire got split up amongst four of his main generals. Some, remained over in Greece. Some, a little bit in Turkey. But for the most part, at least land-wise, two main factions. The one that was centered around Egypt, one that was like Asia Minor, Persia, what we would know as Babylon. Today, of course, this would be Iraq and Iran. And eastward over into India. For our perspective, like right here, right in the middle, the Promised Land, at least at that time, was given over to the kingdom of the Ptolemies, or Ptolemaic rulers, if you will. Of course, as we'll see with the passage of time, it didn't stay that way. Because right there on the border, you know, back and forth, you would expect the conflicts between them. As a result of Alexander's death and the kingdom being divided up amongst his generals. So we see that, at least in terms of, you know, geopolitically. But more importantly for our study today, if you wonder where the Greek language came from, this is where it comes from. In terms of the Grecian Empire, 300, 200, 150 BC, etc. And so much so that the Jews now, in addition to their native Hebrew, learn Greek. And a lot of them learn Greek because it's the language of the day, the language of commerce, the language of transportation, the language, you know, you name it. It's like the dominant language. In some ways, almost like, you know, English is today amongst, you know, several countries. So much so that roughly around 250, a group decided to translate the Old Testament in Hebrew, from Hebrew into Greek. Of course, we know of that as the Septuagint. What's interesting, which I didn't stop to realize, is the names that the Septuagint translation gave to the books of the Old Testament, we recognize. These are not English words. These are Greek words with the corresponding English letters. But in our ability, Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, Ruth, Esther, Psalms, Amos, that's where most of our names for the books we use today in English came from. It comes from the Greek. Likely used by Jesus and the apostles, that translation. Early Christians, etc., used by Jerome in terms of late 300 AD in his translation into Latin. And interestingly enough, found out that the Septuagint is pretty much the standard version still used in the Greek Orthodox. Let me try that again. Standard version used in the Greek Orthodox Church still today, more than 2,000 years later, which I thought was interesting. The Septuagint Greek translation, because of the popularity of the Greek language. Now, during the same time period, there's another event going on, which is somewhat significant for us from a Bible study perspective, and that's what are called the Dead Sea Scrolls. So from roughly 380 BC, all the way past the time of Christ, on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, there was a Jewish settlement, Kerbet Qumran. And I'm not exactly certain why I didn't study this in depth, but they would take a lot of their writings and squirrel them away in various caves in the area for a number of years. Roughly 1,000 of them survived 2,000 years, give or take, until they were discovered in 1946 through roughly 1956 in 11 different caves. What's significant to us of those manuscripts, about 40% of them covered the Old Testament writings. And covers it so much so that pretty much parts from all of the books that we recognize in the Old Testament are covered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, okay, fine. So what? Well, you may not realize it, but before this discovery, the manuscript evidence we had for the Old Testament only went back as far as about the 10th century AD. I mean, that's, you know, 1000 AD, so you're about 2000 years removed from the actual events. with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that pushed those ancient manuscripts all the way back to, you know, back another 1,000 years prior. And what's especially interesting is when you compare the manuscripts from then, the newly discovered ones, with the manuscripts we had from 1,000 years later, not that many differences across, you know, almost 2,000 years of history, or 1,000 years of history, excuse me, which points to the, in many ways, Christian evidence is the reliability of the transcripts, manuscripts that we have, reflecting, at least from the Old Testament perspective, you know, a fairly reliable transmission process across, you know, 1,000 years, not a lot of changes. So that can also serve as like a faith-building evidence, if you will. So, Dead Sea Scrolls, that's kind of where they fit. Now, I mentioned earlier the Maccabees. Now, if you're not familiar with the Apocrypha, who are the Maccabees? Well, let's recognize that Judea, originally under the control of Alexander the Great's general in the Ptolemaic kingdom we mentioned earlier, you know, pretty much the Seleucids eventually take over, at least that part of the eastern Mediterranean, and the land of Judea comes under their control roughly around 170. Well, the Ptolemaics were relatively tolerant of the Jews and Judaism. The Seleucids definitely were not. Under Antiochus, and I probably mispronounced that, my apologies, the fourth, he launched a series of religious persecutions against the Jews, ordered them to worship Zeus, Greek god, their supreme god, and actually went so far as actually polluting the temple with various pagan things. Well, they're, at least according to 1st and 2nd Maccabees, and at least according to Josephus, there was a family that pretty much was instrumental in staging a revolt against that kind of religious persecution beginning around 165. And, at least according to those sources, resulted in the Seleucids being defeated, the temple being rededicated roughly around 164, which, if you didn't realize it, that's where the Festival of Hanukkah comes from, also known as the Festival of Lights, roughly around 164 BC, with the Maccabean rebellion. Okay. So we've seen the rise of Alexander the Great, Greek culture, language, Septuagint translation, etc. And at least starting around 164, a relatively quiet time where the Jews were fairly independent, if you will, of the neighboring nations and could practice, you know, their laws or religion as they saw fit. However, something else is going on, which we alluded to in our summary at the beginning. We have the rise of the Roman Empire. Anchored in Italy, initially, city of Rome. You know, they rise to become, you know, the next major world power. And at least according to the prophecy of Daniel, they are the fourth major world empire. After the Babylonian, after the Medo-Persian, after the Grecian, now we have the fourth major world empire. If you remember the prophecy of Daniel, during the times of these kings, something special will happen. And like world empires, the Grecian Empire falls to them. And eventually the empire expands to the point where the land of Canaan falls under their influence, roughly around 65 BC. Now, you may, from school history, recognize names like Julius Caesar. You know, this is roughly his time period. Mark Antony, Cleopatra, you know, they're in this time period as well, with Roman influence now coming into Judea. Increased commerce, increased trade, exchange of ideas, and, of course, Roman rulers starting off at least around 47 BC with a person by the name of Antipater. butchered that name, sorry. And you might not recognize him. He was appointed by Julius Caesar. But you'll definitely recognize his son, Herod the Great, who rules roughly from like 37 BC to roughly 4 BC. And, of course, he was notable for a number of different things, not the least of which was, you know, greatly expanding the complex around the temple. And, as the narrative will pick up in a few moments, trying to get Jesus killed. That Herod. Jesus as an infant. That Herod. So now, at this point, the stage somewhat is set for the resumption of our narrative in the New Testament. Part of that stage being set, as we mentioned before, is the influence of the Greek. And so we've got a lot of terms that are now in play, or will be in play, as the New Testament narrative unfolds. Here's a sampling. Some of them are brought over almost straight from the Greek, if you notice. Again, Greek words expressed with English letters to include the apostles, baptism. You know, there's a transliteration for you, which basically means immersion. That's why we, at least according to King James, we refer to him as John the Baptist, because they didn't translate it, they transliterated it. Should have been John the Immerser. Yeah. Christ comes from the Greek, the anointed one. Deacons, evangelists, you know, Pentecost, a Greek term, 50 days after the Passover. The rise of the Sanhedrin, again, Greek term, especially referring to the Jerusalem Council of roughly 70 Jewish leaders that Jesus is going to have so much trouble with, and his apostles early on, of course. And another interesting term, synagogue. Can't read about that in the Old Testament. What's that? Well, at least according to best we can tell, a local place of Jewish worship probably originating during Babylonian captivity and afterwards. So it now appears on the scene. Even that word. Again, from the Greek. A lot of influence from the Greek. A lot of our words come from the Greek. Particularly, you know, these from the New Testament. The New Testament stage is also set politically with the appearance of a lot of political groups, religious groups, sometimes combination political and religious together. Things you don't read about in the Old Testament that only suddenly appear in the New Testament. You have Hellenists, which is another term for Jews who not only spoke Greek, practiced Greek, but kind of embraced Greek. And the language and the customs of the Greeks. And you can read about them in Acts 6 a little bit. You have the Herodians. Well, they're the ones that were supporting basically the family of Herod, Antipater, Herod the Great, and his descendants that also have the name Herod, which can be very confusing. But we see several generations of those in the New Testament. Pharisees, Sadducees, Zealots, all rising during the silent years. Of course, Pharisees mainly being separatists, and you can read a lot about them. Historically, first mentioned roughly around 150 BC, likely as successors to those who were part of the Maccabean revolt against, at the time, Seleucid influence. Sadducees, hard to tell. I mean, they're mentioned throughout the New Testament. Origin, somewhat uncertain. Some scholars believe that they were Jews influenced by the various worldly Greek customs, because they seem to have a lot more, I'll use the word, liberal view of the Old Testament scriptures. No angel, no resurrection, no afterlife, etc. And then you have the Zealots, or at least a Zealot mentioned in Luke 16:14. Trace those back to the Maccabean revolt. In our vernacular today, I mean, I don't know whether you would call them freedom fighters or terrorists, depending on which side you're on. But again, coming out of the Maccabean revolt some 150 years prior, give or take. Okay. You also have the stages now set from a Greek religion perspective. And depending on your translation, you may see names like Artemis, Hermes, Zeus, or in other translations you might hear Diana the Ephesians. And the silversmiths that were making shrines for her. Mercury, Jupiter. So now you have a Greco and Roman, because the Romans just adopted the same gods as the Greeks had, they just changed their names, religious system in effect. In fact, a lot of the surviving buildings from Greece and from Rome were religious buildings, temples, if you will. The New Testament sages is now also set from a Roman perspective. So we've seen the introduction of Caesar, not just Julius Caesar, but subsequent rulers went by the name of Caesar, just like rulers in Egypt typically went by the name of Pharaoh, and all different kinds of other terms, a lot of them borrowed from Roman military world. Like commander of roughly 100 centurions, legion, you know, roughly 4 to 5,000 soldiers, where Jesus was brought before the soldiers in the praetorium, the palace of the ruler, hall of judgment. Publicans, people who collected taxes for the Romans. They were loved by the Jews, not. We see quaternions of soldiers, and if I remember correctly, this was as either with Peter or Paul. I think that was Peter, if I remember right. And as we mentioned during the Lord's Supper a few moments ago, the institution of, quote-unquote, crucifixion. You can thank the Romans for that. But a number of Roman rulers, Roman customs, are now in play when Luke resumes the narrative, which is where we go. So, what was prophesied? Elijah. So, roughly, again, between 8 BC and 4 BC, give or take, you have two children that are born that will, quote-unquote, usher in a new era. The first, as we've seen in Luke chapter 1, is the son of Zechariah and Elizabeth, a.k.a. John. Eventually, he'll grow up to become, as we said before, John the Baptist, a.k.a. John the Immerser, if the word had been translated, as opposed to transliterated. And now, after almost 460 years of silence, Malachi's prophecy gets fulfilled. According to Luke chapter 1, verse 17, Matthew chapter 11, verse 44. Now, unfortunately, even though he has returned in the spirit of Elijah to parallel the Lord, which he did, one of those Herods, who happens to be the son of Herod the Great, didn't like what he was preaching because John stepped on Herod's toes by condemning him for his relationship with his quote-unquote wife. So he was eventually beheaded for that. Two children. This is the first one. Second child, we know of as Jesus, son of Mary and Joseph. Technically, the adopted son of Joseph. Once again, Herod the Great appears on the scene, as we mentioned earlier, trying to kill the newborn children in the district of Bethlehem. That failed. This person is going to grow up to have several different designations. Jesus of Nazareth, where they eventually settled. Son of Man, which he refers to himself by numerous times. Savior, and most controversial, perhaps for the Jews, son of God. But as we see from the perspective of all of the minor prophets, including Malachi at the end, he is the ultimate fulfillment of their prophecies regarding the coming Messiah and prophet and priest and king over his kingdom. So now we've gone from Malachi, again, roughly 440, across the silent years, And now those Old Testament prophecies are now fulfilled in what we would call the first century AD. Which is interesting because BC, AD, what does that all revolve around? Coming of Jesus, right? Yeah, before Christ and Anno Domini in the year of the Lord. So even our modern dating system comes from that time. So, quick conclusion, silent years. Almost four centuries of the rise and fall of nations, notable events and people, introduction of changing languages, customs, etc. I didn't make this point before, I'll make it now. 430 years. That's longer than the United States has been around. If you go back, historically speaking, I think the first colony founded in the quote-unquote New World around 1607, give or take, to the present day. So you have the founding of Jamestown. Now just think of all the different events that have gone on. The founding of Jamestown, you have the 13 colonies, independence from England, 1812 war with the British, Civil War, discovery of electricity, the war to end all wars, Great Depression, World War II, and everything else that's gone on. The silent years that we just got through describing covers a similar time period with a similar amount of major events that set the stage, as we've noted, for the New Testament. And based on that, there is some value in studying this period of time. Now, it's not inspired. Of course, you have to recognize that. But if you want to better understand New Testament words, customs, culture, context, laws, etc., certainly, hopefully the time we spent this morning covering the silent years has helped to build a little bit of a conceptual bridge, if you will, between the Old Testament and the New Testament that's all packed in those three little dots that we mentioned at the beginning. The silent years. Very important time, setting the stage for what was to come. And of course, what was to come, as we've mentioned, was the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies in terms of the coming of the Messiah, the Anointed One, Savior, Son of God, Lamb of God, sacrificial death on the cross. And then fast forward 2,000 years, and here we are. Personally, I kind of find these sort of, you know, historical kinds of things kind of interesting to at least give you a sense of not only history and not even just New Testament as well, but a sense of where we fit in with the historical narrative in terms of the establishment of Christianity, everything that Jesus did, the things that were written about him, the guidance through the New Testament from the inspired apostles and prophets, etc., which has been providentially preserved for our benefit, as well as our obedience today. So there you go. A little bit of a history lesson about the silent years. In a few moments, we're going to stand and sing number 293. That is encouraging us to not only view this as history, but view it as, this is going to sound a little bit weird, not only view it as history, but view it as something that's relevant for us today. That is the coming of Jesus and his dying on the cross and the forgiveness that we can have through his sacrifice and our salvation. Whether we need to become a Christian, we offer that opportunity this morning. Whether we need to be restored as a Christian, we offer that opportunity. Whether we even need just prayers in the congregation, we offer that opportunity as well as we stand and sing.